Welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I'm your host for today, Brandon Shea Mutella. Tom is away. This is the first episode we've had to record with Tom's new work schedule, but Tom will be piping in. He's going to give us the summary for the film. But joining us live today is our ever-faithful foreign correspondent, Chris Haig. How's it going, Chris?
I am very well. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Right on. I'm very excited to talk about this today. We're discussing the film Blackmail, and there's multiple reasons why I'm very excited. First of all, because it is Hitch's first sound film, and we're out of the silent era, so you know it's interesting, and it's a really different experience to watch a sound film after watching so many silent films. But we also have a very special guest joining us today. Joining us is David Cairns. How's it going, David?
I'm good. Very happy to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. David, you know a little bit about Hitchcock, right? You've had a little bit of experience with his films, right?
Well, I did my own Hitchcock year some years ago, but I sat down and watched every Hitchcock film over the course of the year, one a week. And once I got rolled up in that, I had to watch all the TV episodes he directed as well. So I got through his entire catalog, which was useful, and you gained a lot of insights, hopefully, from doing it. And it was a lot of fun, too. Good project to have, ticking them off one by one and sort of charting his progress and seeing where he improved and where he slid back a little bit, usually circumstances beyond his control. But yeah, lots of fun. The other main thing I've done about him is sleeve notes for the Criterion Collection's Dark Nine Steps, which was a privilege. And I think I may have gotten the job because I'm Scottish, and that's his Scottish film.
Yes. So which is your favorite Hitchcock film?
Probably there's sentimental reasons, but Rear Window is a big favorite because it was re-released in the 80s, and I saw it at the cinema, and I had seen a little bit of Hitchcock, but not that much at that point, and it completely blew me away, and I fell in love with Grace Kelly, and I was on the edge of my seat and was really impressed, and went to see the other films that were being re-released at the same time, which was Vertigo, Trouble with Harry, and I maybe didn't see all of them, but I saw those three, and they'd been out of circulation for a long time. So it was kind of a glorious rediscovery.
Excellent. So what made you to take on the project of watching them all in a year and then watching the episodes? And that was just personal interest?
So, yeah, sort of simple arithmetic, because there's 52 surviving films. They go, oh, of course, that would be a good thing to do. I didn't realize somebody had already done a book on that exact theme. I figured that out later. But it seemed like the right thing to do if you have a blog and you're looking for things to write about. I blog daily because I'm a maniac. And so that would be one weekly entry, but sometimes there would be an extra little bit that I could do. And I think with Vertigo, I probably got two or three pieces.
Excellent. Right on. Well, we're going to jump into his first sound film, which is Blackmail from 1929. And I'm going to go over a little bit of the history and behind the scenes that I found on the film. Now, the information that I've taken has come, as usual, from the Hitchcock Zone webpage, as well as the Wikipedia page for the film itself. So Blackmail is a 1929 British thriller drama directed by Alfred Hitchcock and starring Annie Oundra, John Longdon, and Cyril Richard. It's based on the 1928 play of the same name by Charles Bennett, and the film is about a London woman who is blackmailed after killing a man who tries to rape her. Wikipedia has a release date listed as July 28th, 1929. And originally, after starting production as a silent film, British International Pictures decided to convert Blackmail into a sound film during filming, becoming the first successful European drama talkie. A silent version was released for theaters not equipped for sound, and with the sound version released at the same time. Now, at first I was questioning why would they want to do something like this, but then it kind of came to my realization right now we're almost doing the same thing when theaters will have a 3D version of the film and they'll have a 2D version of the film as well. So not all theaters are equipped for that. So it's not just the advancement in the technology and people wanting to hold on to the old ways, but some theaters wouldn't have been capable of projecting a sound film. So they did produce both versions of the film. Now, one interesting thing that I was reading in my research is in Donald Spotto's book, The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, 50 Years of His Motion Pictures, Spotto writes that the filming was completed, but editing hadn't begun yet when the decision to film with sound was made. But most of the other research that I was able to find said that the decision was made during filming. So I'm going to stick with that. I just found that was an interesting discrepancy that I found while I was doing a little bit of research. The initial adaptation is credited solely to Hitchcock, although Michael Powell later claimed to have provided some input, and contemporary newspapers of the time reported that Garnet Weston was also credited as writing the scenario. And then playwright and stage director Ben W. Levy was hired to provide dialogue for the sound version. Not long after the film's release, Hitchcock told Close Up that his originally planned version of Blackmail began with the arrest of the felon and ended with the arrest of the girl. Two unknown detectives in the very last shot were to be shown talking about the girls they were going to take out to Lyons, and then it would be the coda of the film. However, this was seen as too uncommercial. In later years, Hitchcock stated that he'd always anticipated that Blackmail would be made as a sound film, but the casting of Czechoslovakian actress Annie Ondra as Alice White would seem to contradict that claim. Her accent, which can be heard in the sound test footage, proved inappropriate for her role as a working-class Londoner, and English actress Joan Barry was hired to speak her dialogue off-camera while Ondra mimed the words on stage. As Ronald Deem later noted, I don't think he would have landed himself in that problem had he known he was going to be doing sound. While the climax of the film takes place at the British Museum, much of the footage was achieved in the studio using something called the Schuften process, and I hope I'm saying that right. Although Hitchcock told Francois Truffaut that he filmed these process shots in secret, the producers, this is the quote, the producers knew nothing about the Schuften process and they might have raised objection. This claim seems dubious as the technique had been used for key shots in previous Hitchcock films. Now named after its inventor, Eugene Schuften, the Schuften process is a special effect that allows live action to be combined with a model or transparency in camera. The process involves placing a mirror at an angle in front of the camera so that it reflects the model or the transparency, and a section of the reflective surface of the mirror is then removed so that the studio set behind the mirror can be seen through the clear glass. By carefully lighting the studio set so that it matches the reflective model or the transparency, the final image captured by the camera is a seamless blend of the two. And although effective and used to great effect in films such as Metropolis, the process was replaced by matte techniques which offer greater flexibility, including allowing the camera to pan. And I think that this was how they filmed the scene where Tracy is climbing down the rope at the climax, because Spotto wrote that the Egyptian godhead that is in the shot was actually a miniature. So they must have done something similar with that effect there at the end. Charles Barr's in-depth analysis of the film, documented in English Hitchcock, makes clear that the production process wasn't simply a case of Hitchcock filming a separate sound version after completing the silent film. The released silent version contains footage shot during the sound filming and vice versa, and this gives credence to Hitchcock's claim that he envisaged the possibility of a sound version early on in the production process. And there's a couple of scenes that are different between the two versions. Now, when I was watching, I actually did watch both versions of the film, and I did notice some of them that were different, but not all of them. The scene in the artist's studio where Cyril Richard sings Miss Up to Date, so there was a song in the sound version. The scene in the Lion's Corner house was restaged in the studio as the sound recording equipment precluded reshooting the scenes on location. And then at the breakfast table scene, this is really where I noticed it, because Annie Ondra was actually on the opposite side of the table, what it looked like to me when I was watching it. But with the famous use of the word knife, which, Chris, you really have to go back and watch the sound version specifically for this scene, because it is absolutely amazing what Hitchcock did with sound in that scene. So the breakfast table scene with the famous use of the word knife required Phyllis Monkman to play the role of the gossipy neighbor, as Phyllis Constam was unavailable to reprise the role. And then also in that scene in the silent version, it's the bell chime of somebody coming into the store that frightens her. And in the film, it's this really awesome scene where I got to describe it right now for Chris. So they're talking about the murder, and they're talking about how he was killed with a knife. And so this gossipy woman keeps repeating the word knife, like, over and over, like, way more than anybody would in a normal conversation, right? But what Hitchcock does is all the words in between. So if she said something like, I can't believe that they killed the person with a knife, it would be like mumbles, like it brought down to a mumble where you couldn't hear the rest of what she was saying, just like knife, and then she says the word knife really loud, and that's what startles her in the sound version. It's amazing. So you definitely gotta check it out just for that scene.
I think it's like the first sound equivalent of what Hitchcock always did with picture, which is to make sound subjective. And so you're hearing it the way the character hears it, in the same way that you see what characters see in Hitchcock films, including their dreams and nightmares and their hallucinations or flashbacks. You know, he's putting you inside their head, and now he's doing it with sound. So it's a big step forward.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we'll get into it when we get into the film discussion as well, but there's some other really interesting things that he did with sound in this. Last we'll talk a little bit about the major actors in the film. So Annie Oundra as Alice White, and we spoke in depth about Annie Oundra in our last episode on The Manxman. And if you haven't listened to that episode, please go back, because her life and history is extremely, extremely fascinating. John Longdon as Detective Frank Weber was a West Indian-born English film actor. He appeared in 84 films between 1926 and 1964, including 5 films directed by Hitchcock. Longdon was born in the West Indies. He was the son of a Methodist missionary and was educated at Kingswood School, Bath, Somerset. Originally intending to be a mining engineer, he worked for 2 years in a coal mine in Yorkshire, where he started acting in amateur theatrical companies. An introduction to Seymour Hicks saw him start acting on the legitimate stage, beginning with a walk-on part in Old Bill MP. He played in My Old Dutch with Albert Chevalier. Then he spent time with the Liverpool and Birmingham Repertory Theatres. He also appeared in a stage production of The Farmer's Wife, produced by Barry Jackson, at the Court Theatre in London for 2 years. And the other Hitch films which we will see him in are Elstree Calling, Juno and the Paycock, The Skin Game, and Jamaica Inn. Donald Calthrop, as Tracy, was born in London. Calthrop was educated at St. Paul's School and made his first stage appearance at 18 years of age at the Comedy Theatre London. His first film was The Gay Lord Quex, I hope I'm saying that last word right, released in 1917. He starred as the title character in the successful musical The Boy in the same year. He then appeared in 63 films between 1916 and 1940, including 5 films by Hitchcock. His other Hitch appearances are also Elstree Calling, Juno and the Paycock, Murder, and Number 17. Cyril Richard, as Mr. Crewe, an artist, was an Australian stage, screen, and television actor and director. He's probably best remembered today for his performance as Captain Hook in the Mary Martin musical production of Peter Pan. In 1945, he played Gabriel Einstein in Gay Rosalinda at the Palace Theatre in London, which is a version of Strauss's Die Fledermaus by Eric Wolfgang Korngold, in which he appeared with Peter Graves. The show was conducted by Richard Tauber and ran for almost a year. This is his only Hitchcock appearance. And the last actor we'll talk about is Joan Barry, who was born Ina Florence Marshall Bell, and she was an English stage and film actress whose career straddled the development of talkies. She was born in Carlisle. She had her first role at the age of 15, and Barry appeared at St. James Theatre, London, when she was 17. She memorably dubbed the voice of Annie Oundra in Blackmail in 1929, and the limited sound technology available at the time meant that Barry had to dub the Czech actress in real time, and she performed the role. Barry would again appear in 1931 in the Hitchcock film Rich and Strange. And our Hitchcock cameo, for the first time in quite a long time, we've got one. He can be seen about 11 minutes in the film riding on the train. He's on the left-hand side of the screen, and a little boy is pestering him by pulling down on his hat. So that's the behind-the-scenes information on the film. And at this time, we're going to cut to our absent co-host, Tom, and he's going to give us a summary of the film.
So here's a summary for you of Blackmail, the talking film from 1929. And this is from The Complete Hitchcock by Paul Condon and Jim Sangster. I apologize ahead of time. This summary is about as long as the film. After a busy day's work, Detective Frank Weber is met at the police station by his girlfriend Alice. She complains about his keeping her waiting, as they had planned to go to the cinema. The couple go to a busy cafe where, unbeknown to Frank, Alice has arranged to meet another admirer, and when he turns up, Alice abruptly cancels her date with Frank, waits for him to leave, and then walks off with her new man, Mr. Crewe. So Crewe is an artist. He invites Alice up to his studio. As they enter the front door, a man calls out to Crewe from the shadows. The two talk for a short while, and then when Crewe returns to tell Alice the stranger is just a scrounger trying to get money from him. Scaling the long flight of stairs to Crewe's attic studio, Alice admires the artist's work and asks if he'd consider using her as a model for one of his paintings. The couple flirt and Crewe steals a kiss. Alice decides she must leave, but Crewe grabs her by the hands and drags her over to his bed as she struggles. As she struggles, Alice's hand brushes against a knife lying on the bedside table. Instinctively, she grabs the knife and stabs him. She dresses and sneaks out of the apartment in a daze. Unseen by Alice, the stranger from earlier watches her leave. So, racked with guilt, Alice walks through the West End of London until dawn, reaching her bed only seconds before her mother comes to wake her. The family home adjoins her father's shop, and as Alice sits down to breakfast, she overhears a customer gossiping. The news of Crewe's murder is spreading, and Alice can hardly conceal her guilt. Frank is assigned to the murder case, and as he searches the dead man's room, he finds a glove that he recognizes as belonging to Alice. Frank goes to see her on the pretense of needing to use their telephone, but once he gets Alice alone, he returns the missing glove to her, thereby revealing that he knows she is somehow involved. Before he can talk further, though, a man enters the shop. It's the man who was lurking outside Crewe's flat the previous evening. His name is Tracy, and he reveals that he managed to obtain Alice's other glove from the scene of the crime. He hints that she might be open to blackmail, then invites himself to breakfast, confident he can exploit the situation to his advantage. However, at the local police station, Crewe's landlady makes a statement claiming she'd seen Tracy hanging around recently. On this evidence, the order is given for Tracy to be arrested for Crewe's murder. Back at the shop, Frank learns of this new development. Though he is confident he can lay the blame on Tracy, Alice is terrified and begs her boyfriend to let her confess. Tracy tries to talk Frank around and pleads with Alice to persuade him not to take the matter any further. The police arrive and Tracy escapes through a back window. A chase ensues and eventually Tracy is cornered at the British Museum where, trying to escape via the roof, he falls to his death. Meanwhile, Alice goes to the police station to turn herself in, but before she can make her confession, Frank returns to tell her that Tracy is dead. He persuades her to let the blackmailer take the blame, and the couple leave the station together.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Tom. We appreciate that. Well, let's jump into why we're here. Let's talk about the film. We'll start with our guest today. David, tell us, do you remember the first time you saw this film and what you thought about it?
I can remember two times because, of course, I eventually saw both versions. And so for Hitchcock year, I finally tracked down the silent one, which had been incredibly hard to come by. But it recently become available, I think. So I had seen Blackmail and enjoyed it and then seen it again and been bored by it and seen it again and enjoyed it again. And then the silent version, it's really fascinating because it's such a schizoid film. There's two versions of it. And I think you could argue that the silent one is Hitchcock's maybe best silent film. I think it's it's only his second thriller, really. And I think it probably has the edge on The Lodger. And the sound version is his best sound film for quite a few years. I think he discovered all sorts of things with it that he just wasn't allowed to do again. And so not until you get him making more thrillers you get anything as good as Blackmail. So I think it's a very strong one. it touches on so many of his themes. It has a Hitchcock blonde. It has guilt and crime and innocence and persecution and the police as a force of terror rather than salvation. All these things that he's interested in throughout his work. So it's very archetypal, and it's also just a really strong example of that, with a sympathetic protagonist in a terrible situation, and he just turns the screws relentlessly on her and on the audience, and I think has a pretty good time with it. But yeah, I think my current feeling about it is it's a very strong film and an important film in both its versions.
Which would you prefer? Do you prefer the sound version or the silent version?
I've had the pleasure of seeing the silent version now with a live orchestral score, which was terrific. I find it really hard to choose because I think they're both pretty important. Certainly made better talkies than Black Male. He maybe didn't make better silence, but it's I find it the talking one is absolutely fascinating because it's so much more sophisticated than the next three or four talkies that he made, because it was a silent film, because it's been thought out visually, and then he's just had to impose sound on it. Whereas you see with the next few films, he's really struggling to make anything interesting because he's been reduced to basically shooting coverage with a camera and in order to accompany what the microphone wants to do. Right. And the filming of the dialogue is superior in Black Male, but also there's lots of stuff going on that's not dialogue and is really interesting visually. So I think it's interesting that and strange that it took him, I think, maybe 3 years to get back to the place that he'd arrived at with Black Male and make a really fluid, involving, engrossing, visually inventive talking picture. Mm-hmm. It's got a really nice score by Hubert Bass, who's, sure, he's no Bernard Herrmann, but he does a very good job. And it's a very full score at a time when scores for talking pictures were basically not being done. The music disappears from the next few Hitchcock films, and because it was hard to do. But because this had been shot initially as a silent, they had all of this score and they used it. And it's like it's a clue as to where cinema is going to go, but hasn't actually arrived at yet. So Hubert Beth, if anybody had noticed it and encouraged him to do more like that, you know, would have been one of the very first proper film composers. Him and the guy who did the Laurel and Hardy films, I guess.
Okay.
Which have a lot of music.
Yeah. Chris, what are your initial impressions on the film?
As long-time listeners to the show might be aware, I've been quite frustrated with a lot of the films when they come across because either the plot's quite weak or the characters are unsympathetic or anything like that. For the first time in a long while, I really enjoyed this. I think the lead performance and kind of the whole conceit of, you know, the Black Male in question is really good. It's a very solid thriller premise that has kind of, you know, I wouldn't say it set the template, but it's a format that has been repeated and it's kind of been adapted, you know, quite a number of times. I, you know, visually, I think it's much more put together than other films I've seen with this. I've seen, you know, different set pieces, and as we go later into kind of Hitch's filmography, he does like a good kind of set piece to sort of tie everything together. He likes, you know, using the Statue of Liberty or the British Museum or the Royal Opera House or, you know, something like that as a big finale, and I think that's genius, and I really like seeing it in this. But yeah, I thought it was a much better film. I mean, the first time I saw it, you know, it feels like yesterday because it literally was yesterday, the first time I've seen this. And then I watched, like, I won't say a half, but I watched, like, certain points to refresh my memory for notes and everything today. And it was really good. It's a very well-done film. And like I said, I've only seen the silent version, so I haven't had the pleasure of hearing the sound the fully sound version yet. But as a silent film, even if technically all the ones we've listened to before are silent ones, it already feels like a much stronger product. It already feels like, oh, okay, so we've got a plot that is actually really engaging. You've got characters who you root for. You know, you've got it kind of evokes a bit of sort of like Dial M for Murder in the sense of, like, you know, there's an innocent woman who's, you know, defending herself and she gets charged for this, or she's going to get implicated in this or this sort of crime. It's kind of like she really does have your sympathy and everything, and I think that's really good and really enjoyable. And the characters surrounding her are really good. So you've got her parents, you've got the inspector who, and it really threw me, but it's because I've just seen The Shape of Water. He looks so much like Michael Shannon that it really threw me for a second, because I was like, he's the villain in Shape of Water, and I was like, oh, he looks so much like the bad guy, but he's actually a good guy. And it's like, it threw me a bit, but it's just it's very well done. Like I said, stylistically, it's shot very well. Everything, the only way I can kind of describe it is everything seems a bit crisper. Everything seems a bit more composed. Everything, because before when we've gone through stuff like, you know, The Manxman or Downhill or something like that, it all felt a bit kind of grainier. It was just felt a bit off in a sense. But looking at this and looking at kind of the ones that are going to come in this next big stage of Hitch's life in the black and white kind of talkie films, I just really enjoyed it. I think it touches on some fantastic themes, you know, like David said, it touches on guilt, it touches on kind of culpability, kind of sin, and, you know, all these kind of complex ideas that, you know, do get to be at play there. And even the ending, so for those of you who haven't seen it, the ending is, technically, it's a victory, but the last,
because
I want your guys' opinion on it, because the last thing that happens is the lead hero, I think her name's Alice, because I'm really bad at her names, Alice and her kind of detective love interest, and it's been like, oh, okay, it's all solved, it was self-defense, I'm not going to put you in prison, blah, 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 that sort of thing.
Well, just one second here, Chris. Let's talk about the ending in a little bit here, because there's a couple things that I want to talk about leading up to the ending. No, that's okay. There's a couple plot points that I want to talk about and a couple of parts of the film that I want to address first. And the first thing that I want to talk about before we get there is, so there was two plot points that I personally would have liked to have seen flushed out a little bit, and maybe you guys would disagree with me, but the first plot point is, so Alice's character is waiting for her boyfriend, who's the cop at Scotland Yard, the detective at Scotland Yard. They're going out for dinner, and when they end up in dinner, he's saying that he wants to take her to a movie. She says she doesn't want to go to a movie. Then she says she does want to go to a movie. And when he gets up to go look for the waitress, she pulls a note out of her purse that says, I'm going to be here next week at 7:30 on Tuesday. Are you going to be here? So she's looking for somebody else. And when her boyfriend sits down, she sees behind him that this person that she's waiting for, who's this artist, is there. And so it's the first time I watched it, I was a little bit confused as to, okay, so what is she waiting for and why is she waiting for this person? And do you think it might have been necessary to get that initial meeting or a little bit of backstory on that original meeting and why they were there? Because she went there on this date hoping to see this other guy, right? And she didn't see him, so then she makes this back and forth of whether or not she's going to go to the movie with him. She says, yes, I will. And then she sees this guy there, and she says, no, I won't. And he leaves, and she leaves with this artist. And her boyfriend, the cop, sees her leave with this artist. So that's the first plot point that I kind of felt needed to be flushed out a bit more, and I wanted to get your guys' take on that. Chris, what did you think on that? Do you think that needed more, or were you happy with that?
I mean, I kind of inferred from it, because initially the note thing, I thought, oh, she just received it, and it's like, you know, hinting at an affair or that sort of thing, or is it somewhat, you know, as I believe to be the case, was like, she received the note and then arranged the date, so she kind of didn't go there on her own to meet him, and it was kind of suspicious, so, yeah, a bit of extra, I don't know where you would have put it, though, unless it might be like a couple of extra bits of dialogue in the section where they meet, and it might be because, like I said, the sound version, I've not heard it, where it's like, oh, I got your note, and you know, that sort of thing, that would have maybe cleared it up a bit, because there was that confusion where she's there, like, you know, because I didn't get why she was going back and forth initially with the note, and I was like, I didn't quite get that, but I think you're right, a bit of clarification, even if it was just like a line. Mm-hmm. Or just like a couple of lines just to go like, oh yeah, I got your note, or, you know, thank you for sending me this, or, you know, I've heard you're an artist. Even something just really kind of a bit clunky, I wouldn't mind, because right, it would just kind of iron out that little sort of plot hole a bit.
Because when she goes back to his room, I get the impression that they don't know each other well. Right? So that's the impression that I get from Alice and this artist character, which I'm sorry, I can't remember his name right now, but Alice and the artist character.
Yeah.
David, what do you think about that? Do you think that's something, are you comfortable with the way it was?
I'm okay with it. There's a little hint of backstory there in that the note is written on a corner of a cocktail menu, and you can read the words nippy cock at the bottom of the page, which is maybe a little Hitchcock signature. So they've met in a nightclub. Clearly, okay. If you're not going to get a cocktail at a Lion's Corner House, you're going to get a pot of indifferent tea, I guess, or maybe some cakes. So they've met on a previous occasion, but it's presumably been a sort of casual.
Right, yeah. I got that it was just a brief.
So I think he's done what he wanted to do, and he's presented it in this way so that it's a little bit mysterious and therefore intriguing. We know she's up to something, and that makes her more interesting, not necessarily more sympathetic because she's seeking around. But on the other hand, by presenting it lightly, we don't see her meeting this guy and plotting to two-time her boyfriend. She's not seen as a betrayer. She's seen as somebody with a secret. And so by the time we figure out what's going on here, she's defending her honor and we're back on her side again. So I guess it's a way to make her more likable by not stating right away what she's up to. And also... A little bit of intrigue is always good.
Right. And then the other plot point that I would have liked a little more clarification on, but it is interesting that it's mysterious, gives this film an interesting depth because it's an accident. So Tracy, who is like stalking this artist as well, right? Because he keeps bothering him and the artist's landlord writes down this note, right? And that's how Tracy gets involved in the case. And so I'm curious as to like, so how did Tracy get involved? Like, what is he wanting out of this artist? Because Tracy accidentally falls upon the murder by being outside the building at the time of his death.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I don't know, like that's maybe not as much, but I found that to be a really interesting plot point, which really expands the feel of the movie because there's this whole other completely unrelated plot point that's just touched on by this guy just being out there at that time.
And he's kind of the embodiment of the inescapability of guilt. Because you think you're going to get away with something, you think you can keep it a secret from everybody, but there's some force out there. And in this case, it's our blackmailer. It's a little bit like the plot of The Reckless Moment, which is a very good 40s noir with Joan Bennett and future Hitchcock star James Mason, where a blackmailer shows up who had acquired some letters from a sleazy guy, which he thought would probably not be worth very much. But now the sleazy guy's been murdered, and so the letters are suddenly really valuable. So it's a kind of a very effective kind of a relay plot. You have a tense situation with her killing a guy, then you have another tense situation where there's somebody who knows about it and is potentially a threat to her. So I guess if you don't want a film to be all about the one thing all the time, then a plot which sets up one situation and then snowballs it into something else is a really useful thing to have.
So the one thing that we do on this show is we tend to take a look at the film and like, what would happen if this were made now? Because, you know, I'm 37 years old and I've only got the experience of my life right now. I'm not a historian. I don't really know what life was like back in 1929. And I look at this film right now, especially in the wake of the Me Too movement and all this. And it's like, how would this film be made now where you have a woman who's murdering somebody in defense of preventing herself from getting raped? And watching this movie, I'm like, I don't quite understand why she's so worried about it when, like, maybe it's me and maybe it's my delusion. But, I mean, if this guy's trying to rape her and she can't get out of it and the only thing she can do is stab the guy, that's self-defense and that's something that maybe has to be done to save herself in that situation. Chris?
True, but if you frame it in a different way... So say she, you know, she kills him, goes to police and everything. If they, because they will charge her. She, you know, she says, oh, it was, you know, it was self-defense, all that sort of thing. Except you've then got, it's her word against his. She was, you know, seen by her boyfriend leaving with him. So it's more, I think it's more that back then, you know, unfortunately it was still kind of like... you know, a woman's kind of opinion on the thing, or kind of her perspective was less likely to be believed, or it's more to be like, oh well, no, she clearly killed him in like a jealous rage, that sort of thing. Because I think she was changing, she was naked, was she still in that dancer's outfit?
Yeah, the ballerina outfit. That and sort he of took thing. Her clothes so, and like.
Yeah, so it would imply like an affair, because there'd be blood all over the clothes or anything. You know, saying, oh, why were you kind of half naked when when you killed him? Why did that happen? So I can see them in the context of the time trying to frame it as like, oh, okay, it was like a lover's quarrel, or it was like a premeditated thing, you know, who knows, rather than it being self-defense. So I get that, but then equally, I think, for the context of the movie, it is panic. It is that sort of like, you know, no idea what's going on, so you're just like, oh god, I've got to run, because she has just, you know, survived, you know, an attempted sexual assault. You know, her mind at the time, I'm not, you know, kind of speaking for the character or anything, but I can sort of imagine, oh okay, how panicked she would be, and how kind of like disconnected from it. You know, he steals a kiss from her and she gets really mad with him. So I think that sort of implies that she wasn't really going there for that type of relationship. She might be going for something else, or, you know, just, you know, different factors that led her to going up to the artist's, you know, studio flat. But it's a tricky one. She's a really sympathetic protagonist because she doesn't do anything to, like, I mean, obviously she doesn't. She's not there saying, like, oh yeah, I'm going to wear a skimpy top and just, like, you know, that deserves a guy to try and, like, assault me or anything. Of course it not. But back then, I could just sort of see how it would have been a bit slut-shaming. It would have been like, well, you stabbed him because he tried to have a fondle with you. But it's like, well, maybe you shouldn't have been wearing that in the first place. Maybe you shouldn't have been doing that. Maybe you shouldn't have been doing that. So I'm not saying it's this big kind of feminist, you know, critique or anything. But I think in the context of the film, it is something that I suppose needs a bit of extra consideration. Because it's all well us as three guys going like, oh yeah, well, you know, why don't you just, you know, she's stabbing everything, of course they'll believe it. You know, saying, well, it doesn't always happen. There is a genuine gender disparity between people who, you know, claim self-defense and how often they're believed based off their gender. It does happen. So,
David, what do you think?
Well, I think, yeah, going back to 1929, you've got the problem just of her being a single woman in another man's apartment. So at the very least, if this came out, her reputation would be destroyed. Yeah. And she went to the police. Yeah. She goes to the police right there. You know, she's probably facing jail time just because she's killed a guy. Self-defense doesn't necessarily cut you any slack in those days if they think you should. Well, she shouldn't have been there. Mm-hmm. If she hadn't been there, none of that would have happened. So, yeah, I think the way the social attitudes at the time would form an additional pressure. But I think she just wants to get the hell out of there and thinks at that point that the best solution would be for nobody to know that she was there. Unfortunately, she's, you know, not a professional criminal, and she's left behind a colossal amount of incriminating evidence, which can then kickstart the rest of the plot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's one of the things where us as the viewer, we're like, yeah, that guy deserves to be stabbed in the back. Like, what a douche, you know? He's trying to rape her. That's not a good thing, and, you know. But I guess, yeah, when you look at it from that perspective, that there are other considerations that are kind of lost with time that aren't as big a concern now as they would have been back then, right? So it's kind of interesting to watch it and to watch these things with a little bit of distance and see. And sometimes those things are forgotten and missed by us in this modern viewing times.
One thing I think is notable is that although Hitchcock is clearly a little divided on the subject of her guilt and whether she should be punished or whether she should be at least exposed and let justice take its course. You can see all sorts of questions circulating there. He's not remotely sorry that that guy's dead. You know,
no, we never, that is nice.
We never meet a grieving relative. There is no downside to that guy having a dagger in him other than that she's in trouble. So that's good.
Yeah, there's no attempt to humanize. There's no going like, yeah, he maybe an attempted rapist, but look, he had a mother, he had like a dog. It was like, nah.
Yeah, he was a passable commercial artist, and that's it.
Excellent. So we move on to the scene with her the next morning. We actually get this really nice montage of her walking all night because she's just trying to comprehend what happened to her. And we get this really interesting scene, which I'm guessing this guy has followed her. Tracy has followed her all night because her cop boyfriend shows up. He talks with her in the phone booth, which has a glass window. He shows her that he found her glove at the scene of the crime, because when they were having dinner earlier, one of the callbacks was that she had left her glove at a previous table. So, this is when he starts to blackmail her. And while this blackmailing is occurring, he's basically saying, look, he has the other glove, so he must have gone up to the room after the fact, right, as well. Tracy has the other glove, so he must have gone up to the room after she left, and he proceeds to blackmail her for the murder. And he starts with makes him buy a fancy cigar, and then they feed him breakfast. The boyfriend cop from Scotland Yard calls into his office and discovers that the landlady has seen this Tracy guy around because he was hanging around trying to talk to him. So this Tracy guy is now a suspect. And because he's a suspect with a criminal record, he's now the police's lead suspect in the case. And so they're able to turn the blackmail back onto him, and he ends up on the run through this amazing sequence through the British Museum. But the first question before I get to there is, in the sound version, they're talking about how the gossipy woman is talking about how she would never, ever stab anybody with a knife. She definitely has got to bash them on the head. That's the British way, is to bash somebody on the head. Now, I know you're from Scotland, but Chris, you're from Britain. Is that the British way to murder people, is by bashing them on the head?
I mean, in my limited experience of committing murder, I'd say... sometimes, I mean, if you're going to hit someone on the head, make sure you use like a leg of lamb. So then you kill them, and then you just go on with dinner.
Yes.
Does it mean that you sometimes have to step over the corpse? Yes, but Sunday dinner, it gets in the way of nothing. So, yeah, I don't know. I just, yeah.
And that is another obscure Hitchcock reference for the listeners.
I know. I'm gonna. Do you know? I've done it three times in probably successive episodes, and I'm waiting for someone on Twitter just to go, you stop talking about this one bloody thing. And then I'll be like, moving on to the next reference. I thought that was an interesting line. Yeah. Every time you say the word knife, though, now I'm just going to be... They can't see this because we're video recording, but I'm just going to be there going, knife!
Knife! Knife! So this museum, this is an actual museum in Britain?
Yeah. The British Museum.
I think so, yeah.
Yep.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Oh, right, the British... Yeah. British Museum, yeah. For some reason, I thought you were like, is it a museum of knives or something? I was like, I don't think so.
It's the British Museum. It's We see it in Night of the Demon, also written by Charles Bennett. We see the library, anyway, which is, I think, an adjoining building. And we see the library as well as the museum in this, I think. And yeah, seemingly it's a combination of surreptitiously taken photographic plates and this model shot, so it's a mixture of fantasy and reality with the figures placed into it, which is a classic Hitchcock thing to do, just fake everything when you can. I mean, he didn't even do that out of not being allowed to go somewhere. He did that usually just because he preferred not to leave the studio. In this case, we're told they were forbidden to go to the real place, but you know, I think Hitchcock might have even preferred it this way anyway. More comfortable.
Excellent. Yeah, it's a pretty interesting climax of the film. They end up on the top of the building somehow. Like they climb everywhere and they end up there on the very top. And this guy Tracy's about to accuse Alice when he falls through the glass of the roof and plummets to his death. And at this time is when Alice is going to the police station to confess, and she had written a note saying that even though this guy Tracy is now the prime suspect, she doesn't want him to be punished for his crime. And we've got this awesomely tense scene where she's standing in front of the what's the term, the major police detective, who's her boyfriend's boss,
yeah.
And she's about to confess everything, and he takes the telephone call, and he says, here, you go deal with your girlfriend and go find out what she wants. And they walk out of the building. That's when they find out what happened and how the guy's dead, and the case is not going to get pursued because they assume it's him. And we get what you were talking about earlier, Chris, with this really bleak ending. Like, she wins in that she's not going to go to jail, but, like, she is not happy at the end. Like, she's got this very bleak look at the end of it. And I think back to, was it Easy Virtue? The last shot of Easy Virtue where she's this really bleak ending to the film where she's like, she gets divorced again or whatever. And then she, at the end, she's like, take it all. I've got nothing left to give, or whatever it is she says.
Yeah.
It really made me think of that final shot of Easy Virtue.
That final shot on the line, what is it? It's such a good line. It's like, go ahead and shoot. There's nothing left to kill. Something like
that's
that.
Right. Yes.
Which is a brilliant line. I love that. But no, with this one, I didn't think it was as bleak, but almost bleaker in a different way, because you've got, you know, like, I am just going to just talk about the scene just like a tiny bit. So spoilers if you've not seen it, but it basically is Alice and the inspector boyfriend. It's sort of wrapped up. Tracy's dead. And it's kind of like, oh, okay, they can move on with their lives, you know, that sort of thing. And then the last shot is a policeman, and it's Alice reacting to this, and it's the painting that she and Crew, that's the name of the artist, she and Crew were painting, and she signed a name over it and then painted over it. It's that, and so you would think, oh, okay, painting, you know, if they're closing up the case and everything, yeah, that's fine. But it's also the fact that it's of a clown, and it's the way it's filmed, it's as if it's pointing and laughing right at her, the way it's framed. So I was really confused at first, because I was thinking, like, is this like a hint that it's all going to come out anyway? Is it like kind of like one final practical joke, or like a Tales of the Unexpected Twilight Zone twist or something like that? But I think it is just, it's a little, I think it's a little alluding to the fact that even though she's won, you know, and she's, you know, going to move on with life and everything, it will still stick with her. There's no kind of getting away from this kind of trauma and getting away from this kind of, you know, experience. As much as you'll try and put it behind you, you'll never be fully rid of it, effectively. And that's what I thought that was, because you never see, once Alice reacts to the painting, you stay with the painting moving off, and you never see Alice's, like, reaction. It doesn't really end with her, but it ends with this painting being carried off and everything. And I just thought it was a really interesting way to end it, because it doesn't end, because Hitchcock tends to end on very kind of powerful endings, and this is a powerful ending, but in a much more subtle way. And it is bleak in one sense, because it's kind of like, well, that's what's left after, you know, the death of two men and this kind of like horrific experience for this young woman and everything. And then it's also because it's this grotesque smiling face of a clown, and it's a horrible clown. Yes. I'm not huge on clowns to begin with, so I was just a bit like, oh, okay, that's not. And it just seems really sinister and really dark. And so that's why initially I was like, oh god, does this mean that it's like they're gonna like mess around with the painting and find her name and then question her some more and then it all comes out, or, you know, that sort of thing. But no, in my interpretation of it, it's more what he tried to do to her and what she did to him will kind of stick with her for the rest of her life. There's no kind of like sweeping it under the rug, mm-hmm. sort of thing. And that's the last twist, in that there isn't really a happy ending. It's just, you know, a moving on.
I think that's exactly right. And I think Hitchcock was asked to produce can you make the ending happy? She can't go to jail. It's got to be a happy ending. So he very cleverly has them all laugh and shows a laughing painting. But they're not happy. And he realized that the people who were asking for this did not have a sense of irony, and he could get away with this. He could make a really conflicted, disturbing, upsetting ending. And by having everybody laugh, you could call it a happy ending and get away with it.
Yeah.
Well, it's even better in the sound version, that ending too. Like, the way that they're laughing, and they're like, oh, women. Next thing, we're going to have women police officers. Ha, 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 ha.
Wait, did they seriously say that?
Yeah, pretty much in a nutshell. And then the guy who's the security guard at the door, he's like, yeah, but at least my job will be safe. He's like... It's like, I don't know,
oh, women police officers, they're only good for cups of tea and looking at.
Not quite, but it's like, because she's there to, she's there to give information on the case, right? And her husband's the one, or her boyfriend's the one who's investigating, so he's like, careful or she'll take your job, right? If she's here providing the information on the killer, you know, she can take your job, buddy, but at least my job's safe. I don't know. It's really crazy.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to listen to the sound version of this.
Yes, definitely going to listen to it. So, one other aspect of the sound that I want to talk about before we finish up here is the way that the sound was used in this film is really interesting, because Hitchcock basically starts the film as a silent film, even in the sound version, and he is gradually adding sound elements to the film. He starts simply with like background noises of like, you know, vehicles and horns and stuff like this. But even in that scene at the beginning where the guys are arresting that one person in that one apartment, there's no dialogue. You can see them talking, but there is no dialogue. And they start to have some ADR. So clearly it was the footage that was used at the beginning. But as the film goes along, it's just these sound elements are slowly brought in. And it's almost like, okay, everybody, we know that you've been watching silent films for 30 years. This is a sound film now, but we got to ease you into it. It almost felt like that's what he was doing, which was really kind of fascinating.
It works beautifully. And I think what it is that, supposedly, according to Michael Balkin, the great British film producer, the British film industry had just decided to ignore the talkies for as long as they could. They just put their heads down and then embarked on a big program of silence. And it's somewhere in there, as you say, it's a little bit ambiguous as to when it happened. They realized this wasn't going to fly, that these films would be obsolete by the time they came out, or semi-obsolete. And so they start creating these sound versions. And I think they made about four features at the same time that were being translated into sound. But the others are all part talkies. I mean, they're legitimately, clearly silent films with intertitles, and then they'll burst into talk partway through. So those movies became the most obsolete of all. You can't see them. They're not available anywhere because they're this strange bastard medium. And Hitchcock very smartly made what he could call a complete talking picture. But as you say, bits of it are clearly still behaving as silent, but they're not.
Yeah.
They're not. There's a sort of alibi for it. They're visual sequences with music, and they behave like silent films, but sort of not, and a little bit of sound effects added. But yeah, he I think for cost reasons, they couldn't remake everything. But it worked out really well, because the blend is kind of is strangely successful. I think Hitchcock thought about it more deeply and cleverly than the other guys, who are just like, oh, well, we have to make two reels of talking picture here so that we can sell this to the cinemas that have been converted to sound. And I forget what, but they were all happening at once. And I remember hearing that, one crew would finish with their little bit of talking picture, and then Hitchcock would be in the next day. So he wasn't even the first to do it, but he did it so much better that he got a full talking picture out of it, or at least something that could be alibied as a talking picture.
Excellent. Well, I think we can wrap it up. David, is there any aspects of the film that we haven't touched on yet that you'd like to bring up?
I guess I'll mention two things involving Donald Calthrop. One is, we were talking about, you know, the suspicions of guilt that would attach to Annie Andra being caught in a stranger's flat with a dead body. Donald Calthrop was entertaining a young actress in his dressing room when she dropped her face powder, which fell onto the electrical heater and caught fire. There was a big cloud of burning powder in there, and she was burned to death. And this was this was a scandal that attached to Donald Calthrop, just because the girl was in his dressing room. It wasn't so much the tragedy of an accidental death. It was, oh, well, what was she doing there? So that kind of...
Was it during this film or
another
film?
I think it's possibly earlier. So he did carry on with a career afterwards. It didn't wreck him, but it definitely hurt his prospects because he was a very busy character actor. The other thing about him is his entrance in this film, where we properly see him for the first time, coming into the shop through a glass door that swings open, and he steps into a big looming close-up and speaks right at us. If you look at Martin Balsam's entrance in Psycho, it's the same shot. It's like they just digitally replaced. They did a Kevin Spacey on him and replaced him with a new actor. It's Hitchcock obviously liked that entrance, thought it was dramatic and effective, and he just restaged it exactly the same. So when you come to Psycho, remember that shot because you'll see it again.
Excellent. Chris, is there any aspects of the film that we didn't address that you'd like to address?
Not at this stage. In all honesty, I mean, I just thought it was incredibly well made. It was just a really enjoyable film. It's probably the one I've enjoyed most, certainly for a while. Particularly, you know, given the fact that we've kind of maybe unfairly ragged a bit on some of the silent ones for certain aspects. Whereas with this, I was like, okay, I really enjoy the plot. I really enjoy kind of the characters. I'm pretty good. I'm pretty satisfied with this one.
Here are some quick thoughts from me on Blackmail. The talking film. This is bizarre. Watching the first 8 minutes of the film, if you didn't know, it could be a silent, it could be a talkie, and nothing really is spoken at first, and you're in that comfort zone of watching a silent Hitchcock film, and suddenly they start to talk in the police station. And that's very exciting, and they're talking in the cafe. Now, that's a historic moment that not anybody would catch it, unless they were really thinking about it. But it is exciting that Hitchcock is moving into the audio world. They no longer have to rely on title pages, and he's able to use audio more, music more, sound effects more, and it's a great transition into the modern world of filmmaking and film storytelling. Interesting story. The murder happens off screen, and that's a sort of a trope of Hitchcock's, where Alice stabs Mr. Crew in the bed, but we don't see the stabbing itself. In a sense, Crew deserves it for the cliche of "come up and see my studio," as such a pickup line. And this is a good story. Like, it's entertaining. It all looks very familiar to me. I must have seen this a few years ago, or else it just reminds me of other films like The Lodger, you know, where the man is living upstairs in sort of a boarding house, and there's a landlady on the main floor and a big staircase to climb. The scenes in the general store of the White family kind of go on and on. But it is a very compelling story. There's a lot happening. The blackmailer gets it. You know, this Tracy guy is a stranger, and he thinks he's going to take advantage of the situation and get some money. And he ends up being chased by the detectives. There's a grand, I love this grand chase scene, this wonderful scene where they run through the British Museum. And, of course, Mr. Tracy falls to his death, and he takes the blame. The dead man don't tell tales, right? He's the one that they assume did the murder. So the story ends in the sense that the murderer is dead as far as everyone's concerned. So Alice is free and clear at the end. And it's a good story. I enjoyed it. Alice is White. You know, her last name is White. She's pure, she's clean, she's innocent. And there's a wonderful image that we're using in the promotion for the episode where she's in her slip with the knife, and she has this look where she doesn't know what she's done. The knife is dripping with blood, and, you know, that very epic scene. No, I enjoyed it for sure. And quickly to wrap up my little bit of comments here on the film, I will give this a 3 out of 5 cigars I can't pay for.
Excellent. I love this movie. You know, I was certain I knew there were some silent films that I hadn't seen, but I was certain that I'd seen all of his sound films, and I didn't remember this. So I'm wondering how many more Hitchcock blind spots I have that I'm going to find over the next couple of movies, because I don't have all of his movies on DVD or Blu-ray, I know that, but I did think that I had seen all of his major movies. So to find this gem was really amazing, and this is my, for sure, this is my favorite so far that we've covered. You know, The Lodger up until now has been my favorite, but this one I think definitely overtakes that position. And yeah. I know that the next couple will be a little bit fishy here and there, but I'm looking forward to a couple of the films that are going to be coming up that I know are very good. I remember really enjoying Jamaica Inn, so I'm looking forward to touching on that one again. I remember thinking that, but that's a few movies away. But but this has been a lot of fun. I really enjoyed this. We had mentioned in our last episode that we wanted to cover some of the remakes of the remake of Easy Virtue that came out, and the remakes of The Lodger that had come out over a few years. I had watched the first one from 1939 or something like that. I can't remember what year it was, where Ivor Novello comes back and portrays the Lodger again in this first talkie version of the film. I know it has another name, which I can't remember off the top of my head, but we just don't have, I don't have the time right now to cover them. Maybe we'll come back to them at some point. So I'm sorry that we promised that in the last episode, but it's just, I've been so darn busy right now, that I just got to stick to the main Hitchcock films as we go along here. Next episode, we're going to be covering Juno and the Paycock, and we're also going to be talking about two other little projects that were happening around this time. I'm hopefully going to try and find a copy of them so we can watch them, but there's two other little things called An Elastic Affair and Elstree Calling that I'll be interested in investigating, doing a little research on. And then after that, we've got a movie called Murder, and I'm going to also try and find a copy of Mary, which is the German version of the film, which Hitchcock also directed. So those are our next two episodes that we'll be discussing here on Good Evening. Before we go, David, please tell us where people can find you, if they want to follow you on Twitter or anything like that, and then promote some of the projects you've worked on, because you've written a movie.
Oh, yeah. My wife and I wrote a horror movie called Let Us Pray, with Pollyanna McIntosh from The Walking Dead, and let's see what else. I blog at a place called Shadowplay, which is dcairns.wordpress.com. I blog every day, so there should always be hopefully something diverting there on movies generally. And I write and make video essays for Masters of Cinema and Arrow in the UK, and for Criterion and sometimes Kino in the US. So as I said, 39 Steps was the one Hitchcock I did, but I rove around and write about lots of stuff, and I'm getting more and more into video essays, which is where I get to play around with other people's movies and tell different stories with them about how they came to be.
Excellent. And Chris, where can people find you when you're not pulling hats down on people on the trains?
Sorry, first of all, I knew your name from somewhere, David. I've seen Let Us Pray.
Oh god.
No, it's on Netflix. I really enjoyed it. I was thinking Let Us Pray, and I just know it because it's the one with Liam Cunningham from Game of Thrones,
yes,
isn't it?
So yes.
I'm like, it's really good.
He's really good in it, and yes, I think we lucked out with our director. Very good guy.
He's so, because I don't want to spoil it, but he's very good in the role that he turns out to be.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, that's good. It's so good. you can find me on Twitter at @Hyatt_by, where I will basically talk about pretty much anything going on in pop culture, from horror movies to RuPaul's Drag Race to anything in between. So please give me a follow on there. Please shoot me a message, say hi. Aside from Good Evening, I also do a podcast called North by Nerd West with one of my best mates, Emma Platt. It's very irreverent take on kind of modern geek and pop culture. We're on a bit of a hiatus at the moment, but we will be coming back hopefully this month with a big roundup of everything that's gone on in the past couple of months. So yeah, that should be a lot of fun.
Excellent. And you can find me over on the Trek FM network with a couple of Star Trek podcasts. I am one of the co-hosts of The Edge, which is our Star Trek Discovery podcast. And you can also find me with Warp 5, which is our Star Trek Enterprise podcast. I'm having a lot of fun over there. You can follow me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. Well, I guess that's all that we've got for you this week. Let's look forward and keep watching some Hitchcock adventures now that we're in the sound film era for sure. So I guess all we have left to say is good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.